Testing
1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
I thought you'd never get down to the younger generation. Well, Mr. Chairman, Reverend clergy, cousin. My father always explained it to me that there was one branch of the family that somehow didn't have to abbreviate because they could handle the larger words.
Touché. Good.
And the several Mr. Mayors, all you gentlemen so distinguished here in public life, gentlemen of the press and gentlemen. You know, I'll tell you, it's kind of hard. I'm so happy, of course, that your good senator here was able to get out on parole and down to spend the evening with us. But when I heard that your councilman of the opposite party is still up there, who's watching the store? Now, seriously, he's one of the embattled few, and you should be very proud, as many of us are who are not particularly of this district. But you know, it's rather hard to decide why I should be picked for this particular spot, whether it has to do with a profession, often maligned, that I might be considering in the future, or whether it has to do with a profession in my past, often maligned. I hardly can believe it's due to the latter when I look at the nature of this particular affair and the significance of it, because I'm not unaware of what most of you think about the people in our business. Most people think we spend all of our time sitting around a swimming pool with a wet blonde in one hand and a dry martini in the other. Of course, that isn't true. There are many people in Hollywood who don't drink martinis at all. But at least there's one thing in which I'm safe. I know the purpose of the evening, and I know something of the gathering that's here. You may not think that's too important, but let me tell you that when you've traveled the mashed potato circuit long enough, you've had that uncomfortable feeling of being introduced and standing up, and you face a group in a strange community. You know very little of what has brought them together, the customs of the mores of the community, and it's hard put to get underway. So it does mean something to be so familiar. You think it can't be disturbing and some things can't be said. I have a friend, he's a member of the Episcopal clergy. He had never been to New York, and he made his first trip there. He knew nothing about the city, and he knew even less of the large Irish-American population there. And he got off the train in Grand Central, got in a cab, said to the cab driver, "Take me to Christ Church." And in about 7 minutes, they pulled up in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. But he knew enough about New York to know that wasn't right, and he tapped the cabbie on the shoulder, and he said, "My good man, I think you've made a mistake. I want to go to Christ Church." And the cabbie looked at him and says, "If he's in town, he's here or no place." I think I should get on with it. You know, it is proper and fitting that you should be recognizing, as you have and as you do each year, these men who serve you in these many posts, ranging, of course, as they do tonight, from national defense, the federal level, but principally at the local and the state level. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence said, "It is not our duty to leave wealth to our children, but it is our duty to leave liberty to them. We have counted the cost of this contest, and we find nothing so dreadful as voluntary slavery." And the declaration they signed was unequivocal in its assertion that every man had unalienable rights to life and liberty and the freedom of choice, and that these were conferred upon him by his Creator. And then they augmented this declaration sometime later by drawing up the United States Constitution with its Bill of Rights. 70 years would go by before England's Lord Acton, the same Lord Acton who coined the phrase that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, would comment on the work of the men who had framed this document. He would say they had solved with astonishing and unexampled success two problems which had heretofore baffled the capacity of the most enlightened nations. They had contrived a system of federal government which prodigiously increased the national power and yet respected local liberties and authorities. And they had founded it on the principle of equality without surrendering the securities for property and freedom. The men who framed this document, the founding fathers of this nation, were great historians. But other than that, they were just private citizens. They were not of the political world. And they contrived a system of government that would be of the people, as well as by and for the people, that would be run by the people. That was the most important thing they had done. They recognized in increasing the national power that there were legitimate functions of government that would be entrusted to the national government, the federal government, such as the defense of our life and liberty in pursuit of happiness. But they also knew, in looking back over history, that freedom was more ensured if you kept as much of government as possible at the local level. And they preserved the sovereignty of the states, knowing that as long as you had a federation of states, each state responsible for its government, that you had a built-in guarantee of freedom as long as people were free to move across from one state line to the other if things became intolerable under the government of any one state. Now we're engaged in a contest to see if the nation and the way of life that they created can endure. There's a lot of confusion about this contest. We're hesitant to recognize it for what it is. Reality, we're in a war. We're in a war not only of nations, but of fundamental philosophies, communism versus capitalism. Now, there are some people today who flinch at the use of the word communism. They'd find another name for it, as if by calling it something else, it might become something else. Well, it won't. Pravda, and the word means truth in Russia, Pravda says of communism, it is all-embracing, all-blood-soaked reality, and its goal is to destroy capitalism. They go on to say there can never be a someday mixture of the two. Well, here we should be in complete agreement. Because you can't be a little bit socialist, nor can we be partly free. Freedom is indivisible. It isn't spelled with an S. These founding fathers warned us, and men since have warned us, that freedom can be lost inadvertently. It doesn't necessarily require some outside conqueror coming in and taking over. A senator, several years ago, called our attention to a danger. He said the scarlet thread running through the thoughts and actions of people all over the world is the delegation of a great number of vital problems to the all-absorbing Leviathan, the state. Every time that we try to lift a problem to the government to the same extent, we are sacrificing the liberty of the people. Now, this was no extremist. This was no man attempting to drag the nation back 100 years in time. This was a young Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Not too long ago, Dr. Howard Kirshner, and he tells today of his visit to the Kremlin. He was visiting a high-ranking Soviet official. And in the course of the conversation, this Soviet official smiled pleasantly, and he said, Dr. Kirshner, we'll be over to finish the takeover sooner than you think. He says, you know that a mixed economy is not permanent, and you have already mixed so much socialism with your formerly free economy that you cannot take it back or change. You are coming all the way into full socialism. We don't have to fight you or urge you. We'll simply wait until you walk into our camp. In his sunset years, the late Herbert Hoover devoted himself to trying to discover an explanation for the wealth, the great industrial success of our nation. He found that other lands had territory equal to ours, had a climate equally as favorable as ours, had people that were as industrious and as energetic and had all the ability and talent that we had. Where then the difference? Well, finally he had to say there was only one thing he found that we had to a greater extent than any other nation. Freedom, individual freedom. Here we had unleashed the individual genius of every man, given him the freedom of choice and the right to fly as high and as far as his own strength would take him. Now, what other explanation could there possibly be for 6% of the world's population, a polyglot mixture from every source, from every national background, and every race, occupying only 7% of the world's land surface, creating in this short span of our tenure as a nation 50% of the world's wealth. But let it be recorded here and now that along with this accomplishment, we have at the same time distributed this wealth more widely among our people than has ever been known in any society heretofore created by man. Poverty in our country, for the most part, is measured by a scarcity of luxuries, where in the rest of the world, poverty is the name they have for people who actually lack in sustenance and shelter. But somewhere along the line, a perversion has taken place. Our rights now are considered to be a dispensation of this government we created, and that our freedom can be made divisible by the will of the majority. The Supreme Court recently, by a 5-4 decision, has handed down a ruling so contrary to the meaning and the thought of the Constitution, the intent, that it's hard to believe that the governors and the legislatures of all 50 states didn't rise up in outraged shock at this destruction of our basic federal tradition. I'm speaking now of reapportionment and the court's outright denial of state sovereignty. Here it was made plain would be the switch from a republic to the mobocracy of majority rule, the idea that 50% of the people plus one could do anything they chose to do simply because they outnumbered the rest. Now, majority rule is a fine mechanism. It's a means of administering our affairs. But it is only acceptable if at the same time we have a set of ground rules that are guaranteed the rights of the individual. One's right to life and liberty, to freedom to worship, to speak, to assemble, in short, our unalienable God-given rights, may not be submitted to a vote. That's the very purpose of the Bill of Rights, to forever put those rights beyond the reach of majority rule. Now, this is the unique nature of our heritage. This is the thing we pass on to our children. And perhaps it's time to check on that heritage and see if they're going to know the freedoms that we have known and that were intended for all of us by the Founding Fathers. I suppose part of the trouble is that when we talk of freedom, it's too much like Fourth of July oratory. We speak in nebulous terms, not dealing enough in specifics. Maybe this is the reason, because we failed in that task, that in a recent survey of 5,000 young people in this country from the age of junior in high school to junior in college, and if you think 5,000 isn't a survey in depth, let me point out that on the basis of only 1,800 questionnaires by Nielsen, television programs come and go, leave the air. But these 5,000 young people were queried. More than half of them said they felt the government should own such things as banks and steel and other parts of heavy industry. Almost two-thirds said the government should provide jobs and that workers should not produce all they can. They rejected the profit motive in the same number as being necessary to our nation or our prosperity, and 84% of them denied that patriotism played any important part in their lives. In too many instances, perhaps they've been reading textbooks that devoted a chapter to public welfare and not one line to Patrick Henry. Maybe they ask some of these young people of ours, who is free? At home, there are my parents. At school, there are teachers. And if I do manage to get the old man's car and get out for a little while, there's a fellow on a motorcycle that makes life pretty miserable for me. Well, I think we have to start telling them in things they can understand what freedom really is. I got an eyeful of this, or an earful, from a man by the name of Wagner. He's a German book publisher. Well, he's an American now, book publisher from Germany. He was educated not in Hitler's Germany, but in the Wehrmacht, or in the parliamentary regime, the German Republic, when they had President Hindenburg, when we thought they had a system of government very similar to ours, freedom such as we know. And one day he told me why he was devoting so much of his publishing business to publishing patriotic literature, even at no profit, for children and young people. He said in class one day, our teacher was trying to explain freedom to us. And he said to us, imagine that you are standing on the shores of America. This German professor said, ahead of you stretches 3,000 miles. He said, you are free to go any place in that 3,000 miles you want to go. Stop wherever you want to stop. Stay as long as you like. And he said, Mr. Reagan, what do you think it meant to me, to all of us in that class, when we lived in what was supposedly a free country, but if we wanted to even move from one apartment to the other in the city, we had to go down to the city hall and get the police permission to do this. Let's tell them that freedom means selecting their own college, their career if they want, or no college at all. Living where they want to, taking a trip without going down and reporting why they want to go, how long they're going to be gone, checking in at the next town as to how long they're going to be there. In Hungary, for example, they still have a law now that if a young couple gets married, they must choose to live either with his parents or hers. And their name goes on a waiting list, and several years later, the government awards them a place to live, and that's where they live from then on. In Russia, they've just announced a new housing goal, that they're going to have a housing program that will wind up with every citizen being guaranteed at least 64 square feet of floor space for himself. 64, 8x8. In the United States, by curious coincidence, the minimum requirement for a prison cell is 80 square feet, 8x10. Let's talk to them not of the Constitution as a revered document because of dusty tradition, outmoded but tolerated because of age. Let's make them understand it's a living document. It guarantees us as a contract the most limited and equitable government that's ever been known in the long history of man's relation to man. There's a clause in our Constitution, for example, that guarantees us the right to meet, to assemble, to speak our minds, even as we're doing here tonight. There's such a clause in the Soviet Constitution. They don't enforce it very much, but it guarantees them the right to speak, to freedom of speech, to assemble, to meet like this. And some people have chosen this and compared them and say, wherein lies the difference? Don't we have a great deal in common? Well, the difference is so great that it tells the whole story, but it is so subtle that it does escape too many people. Let's not let that happen anymore. What is that difference? Well, the Soviet Constitution says, we, the government, grant you these rights. And our Constitution says you're born with these rights and no government on earth can take them from you. This is what we have to tell our young people today. It's the most valuable part of their inheritance, this idea, never before tried in the world, that you and I do have certain unalienable rights, that government is beholden to us, and that it has no other source of power except the sovereign people, and it can do only those things that we permit it to do. But now there's a new philosophy abroad in the land. Men in high place at the federal level of government talk of the need for planning. They question the ability of people to control their own destiny. And many of these people chafe under the Constitution or under the restraints that are imposed on them with regard to changing the Constitution, the slow pace of amendment. And so they embark on a dangerous folly, changing the Constitution by judicial interpretation. Fine the prodigious increase in national power, not so fine the respect for local authority. Ignore the word unreasonable in the interpretation of the article, protecting the citizens against search and seizure. Suddenly, as they drop that word unreasonable and overemphasize this protection, crime skyrockets and our city streets become jungle paths as the hands of local law enforcement officers are tied. And they're well nigh helpless in many instances to protect us. It's hard to believe that such a thing could happen in America as happened in an eastern city under some of these new interpretations of the law. Not too long ago, a policeman saw a Western Union office supposed to be closed at that time. Two men were apparently in there bringing something out. They were lugging it across the sidewalk. He started toward them. And as they saw him coming, they hastened their steps, threw what they had into the back seat, jumped into the car, and took off. He ran up, saw that the door was left standing ajar, commandeered a passing car and took off, managed to catch them and hail them over to the curb. In the back seat was a safe marked Western Union. The case was dismissed. This constituted illegal search and seizure. He had no right to stop them. Take out of context the word welfare. Pretend there is a clause giving the central authority the unlimited power to legislate what it believes is for the welfare of the people. And so we embark under this, and incidentally, there never has been a clause, a welfare clause in our Constitution, and is not now. But we embark on a plan of eliminating slums. Now, certainly no responsible citizen would suggest we shouldn't do this. No one would ask that people live in degradation in a country such as ours. But suddenly we discover we've canceled our traditional laws of eminent domain, our protection against the seizure of our private property. Government can now force the sale of private property, our homes, and then resell to other individuals who will then make a profit from this property. And the entire transaction will be subsidized by tax money. By a strange quirk of the end justifying the means, the same people who deny the policeman the right to legitimate search and seizure in the protection of society turn around when it's at the federal level, not at the local level, and insist on a regulation in the farm program that permits the federal government to seize farms for the violation of regulations and sell them at auction to enforce the payment of the fines for violating the regulations. And the court rules, the Supreme Court, yes, the federal government has the right to tell a citizen what he can plant on his own land for his own use. Free speech is interpreted as meaning that some young Americans have the right to burn their draft cards and block trains that are shipping replacements and supplies to other young Americans who are fighting and dying in a war that isn't a war, and a war that they're denied the right to win. There's no more noble purpose than salvaging young people, particularly young people who, for whatever reason, have failed to meet their responsibility to fit themselves for adult life. But yet we put at the federal level a program in effect to do just this very thing. And then we go so far astray that we find them taking young ladies from poverty-stricken homes to teach them in a retraining program to become self-sustaining, and while they're being taught, they won't have to make their own beds. They're provided with maid service. And the program prorates out at $7,000 for each young lady we're going to help. Well, there are a lot of families in this country that are raising fine, productive citizens on less than $7,000 a year. We take young men and put them in retraining camps, and while we're retraining them, curing them of what is a failure at this point, we pay them a higher rate of pay than we give to the man in uniform who goes out in defense of his country. And there's something very ridiculous in that. Down in Chattanooga is a comparison of what happens when we stray too far from government being controlled where the people are, where the people can see a relationship between the spending of the money and the taxing, the taking of the money. Down in Chattanooga, they've just announced a school budget of $10 million for 25,000 students. But at the same time, the federal government has announced $5 million budget, just about half of this, for the salvaging of 3,300 dropouts in the schools. The legitimate students who have to have the necessity of earning money in part-time jobs are restricted there by law to 15 hours of work a week in addition to their schoolwork. But the dropout is going to be paid for 32 hours a week while he's being retrained, and they suddenly discover they've created an inducement for the legitimate student to become a dropout so that he can be put back into school and double his income. Meanwhile, a United States senator says happily, spiritually and economically, young people are being conditioned to respond to a liberal program of orderly policing of our own society by government. Well, now, sure, isn't that a fancy way to say they'll do as they're damn well told? They're perverting the Constitution so as to make equitable taxation for legitimate purposes a license now for the use of the tax system to redistribute the earnings and the wealth of the citizens of this land and to control the economy. And they've used the people's money in order to coerce the people and to build a government beyond the consent of the governed. Now, we recognize, as I said before, that government at every level has certain legitimate functions. We're proud of those who set our course for the stars, proud of those who guard our shores, of those who patrol our streets and who teach our children. We know that government is a referee in our daily competition with each other to see that no one can step on his neighbor's toes in this competition. But now, government has acquired such a size that taxation has become a family's biggest item, biggest burden, greater even than the expense in a family, average family, for food or clothing or shelter. Since the beginning of the century, just think, we have multiplied the gross national product of this country. It's 33 times greater than it was at the turn of the century. At the same time, we have increased the cost of the federal government 234 times as much as it was at the turn of the century. And still, we're not paying our own way. We're letting our children in on that. We haven't balanced the budget in 29 of the last 35 years. The interest on our national debt is $22,000 a minute, every minute of every hour of the 24, day in and day out. Our government owns a third of all the real estate, the federal government. And only a few years ago, it was just a fourth of all the real estate. Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own state of California. In the case of California, that's not easy. You know, it only takes 12 doctors for every 10,000 of us to keep us on our feet and well and healthy. It only takes 40 oil station attendants and mechanics to keep the cars of 10,000 of us running. It only takes 37 telephone employees to keep this vast communications network going. But when we get to the federal government, it takes 130 federal employees for each 10,000 of us to administer the affairs of the national government. I sometimes think that government's like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Almost 200 years ago, the Constitution was a lighted torch, and it said to the downtrodden of all the world that here men had at last recognized man's age-old yearning to be recognized as an individual. That here men had placed such a premium on the individual that we'd pledged our collective strength, that all of us collectively would go to the aid of even the least among us if the basic rights of that one individual were trod upon or impaired. Now, this belief cannot be reconciled with the high-sounding phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number. Since World War II, 135 American airmen, mostly unarmed, have been shot down, most of them simply for getting off course, whether by weather or failure in navigation, and straying too close to the borders of a nation with whom we're supposed to be at peace. And we wrote notes of protest. Some time back, Americans were held captive by savage rebels in the Congo. They were tortured, and some of them were murdered, while we debated the political consequence of going to their rescue. Well, let me tell you another story, by contrast, and see whether we haven't strayed somewhat from the original purpose of government. Back, more than 100 years ago, back around 1840, when we were just a young, struggling country, when all the great powers of Europe still had a greedy eye on us and figured that they still could perhaps take us over and have this wealth for themselves. There was a revolution going on in Hungary against the power of the Austrians and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, against Emperor Franz Joseph. And it was aborted, and it failed, and some of the rebels fled to America, and one of them, a young lieutenant by the name of Kostya, took out his first citizenship papers in this country. And Kostya went back, he was an importer, went back into the Mediterranean to a port there one day on business. And while he was there, there was an Austrian warship in the harbor. And an admiral on board, word was brought to him of the presence of this man so wanted in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he was kidnapped and taken aboard the warship. His manservant saw a flag that he recognized from descriptions that had been given him by his master on a little American war sloop in that harbor. And he went aboard to the Captain Ingram of that little sloop and told him what had happened. And Captain Ingram went to the United States Consul and he told him this story. And the consul investigated and found out that Kostya had only taken out his first citizenship papers, so he said, "Oh, that washes our hands of any responsibility." And Captain Ingram said, "I don't think so. I'm the ranking officer in this port and I think he's entitled to the protection of our flag if he asks for it." So he went aboard the Austrian warship and he said to the admiral, "I demand to see our citizen." And they brought him on deck in chains, and Captain Ingram said, "I can hear him better without those chains." And they took the chains off, and then he said, "I'll ask you a question. Consider your answer carefully. Do you ask the protection of the American flag?" And the poor devil, who'd been beaten and mistreated, nodded yes. He said, "You shall have it." And then he went back and told the consul what he had done. In the meantime, two more Austrian warships sailed into the harbor, and it looked like they were getting ready to leave. So he sent a lieutenant over with a message. Captain Ingram's message to the Austrians was, "If you attempt to leave this harbor with our citizen, You will be resisted with appropriate force. We will expect a satisfactory answer by 4 o'clock. At a few minutes to four, three giant warships were lined up against one little sloop. The cannons were wheeled out. Just before the clock struck four, he told the men to light those tapers with which they lighted the cannons of that time. And they lighted them, and then a man on lookout called down and said, "They're lowering a boat." And they rowed Mr. Kostya over to the American sloop and turned him over to us. And Captain Ingram wrote out his resignation to the United States Navy. And he said that he did not want to embarrass the country, but he had done what he felt was his duty under the oath of office that he had taken as an officer in our Navy. And on the floor of the United States Senate, his resignation was rejected because they said there, this battle that was never fought may well turn out to be the most important battle in our nation's history. And to this day, there is a USS Ingram in the United States Navy, and I pray God there always will be one. I don't tell this to be chauvinistic or to express a bullying hostility, but because this is the highest function of government, indeed it is government's only excuse for even existing, this idea that loyalty is a two-way street, that government exists only to see that no individual or group in our midst or no outside aggressor can take from the man his God-given right to life or liberty or the pursuit of happiness. Now, to those who say today that there is no simple answer to today's complex problems, yes, there is a simple answer. It's not easy, but it's simple. If you and I will tell those in the higher echelons of government who represent us that we want no double standard of morality, we want no easy political expediency in our collective actions while still at home as individuals we insist on a higher standard for ourselves, that we want legislation to reinterpret the Constitution in those instances where judicial rulings have distorted the meaning, and to make it plain that this is a nation under God, and in God is our trust. And to those who would cancel out this contract or relegate it to some musty shelf in a museum among the relics, let us ask as Daniel Webster did. To those who would do this, but who shall rear again the fabric